It's Monday, March 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a deadly blast rips through one of the busiest sections of Ankara, Turkey. Donald Trump surging closer to the Republican nomination for president.
People want to come out and support their views, so it's really endorsing who they believe and what they believe.
We get a unique peek inside the presidential delegate selection process and voting as a whole. Also ahead, a music favorite for more than four decades. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. A large explosion ripped through the main square in Turkey's capital Ankara on Sunday, killing at least 34 people and wounding 125. 19 are described as in critical condition. Officials said that the blast occurred on the very busy Kızılay Square. The attack comes 2 days after the U.S. Embassy issued a security warning about a potential plot to attack central Ankara and asked its citizens to avoid the area. Alp Esmer is a VOA journalist from Ankara and joins us to describe the area in detail and provide more details of this bombing as it follows two other recent attacks in the Turkish capital.
Well, the location of the bombing, I can tell you this evening. It's Ankara's main center, where a lot of government offices are present, first of all. So it is, in a way, similar in the sense to the previous bombing last February. The area has been under constant police surveillance with a lot of security presence, with a lot of security cameras. I mean, whether civilians have been intentionally targeted is another question that needs answering. But at the same time, that particular area is where hundreds of thousands of people change their buses, metro trains to travel from one part of the city to the other. It's always crowded area. But maybe the only blessing was it occurred in Sunday evening, and possibly with, I'll say, minimal casualties. I know it's over 30 so far, but apparently if it happened during a normal workday, the number of casualties, the number of death toll might have been far more. And another thing I can tell you, I mean, I'm speaking with my friends in Ankara. They're quite often telling me these days, Ankara has become another Beirut. And a lot of them have never been used to such magnitude of violence over there. And what makes it far worse is like when it has become a habit by the government to issue gag orders to prevent dissemination of latest updates or shut down social media sites like Facebook or Twitter. But still, I had a chance to peek through the social media before the ban took place, but you could see most of the messages contain conspiracy theories, groundless blame games. And this is quite enough to show how serious a nation appears to be divided between ethnic and sectarian lines, I'd say.
A lot of the blame for previous incidents has been laid on the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. Obviously, it's too early to tell who is responsible for this, but obviously Islamic State has become an increasing threat to Turkey and Ankara in particular.
Well, it's true. I mean, like, the last explosion was blamed on the PKK. I mean, today the Interior Minister spoke to the reporters, and he said the investigators have collected various evidences in relation to who might be behind the attack. But he refrained from pointing fingers at any particular group or individual. However, he said Turkey's determination to fight against terrorism will not be stopped by such attacks. But since the Turkish government usually refers to its Kurdish insurgency when it mentions the war against terrorism, so by tomorrow, we may not be too surprised to hear from them who the alleged perpetrators of the blast might be. I mean, I'll say Turkey is facing battles on multiple fronts these days, and its Kurdish insurgency, the near-war situation in its Kurdish towns, the Islamic State terrorism, the civil war in neighboring Syria, its international disputes with Moscow and Damascus, they all make it very hard to speculate who might be behind this attack in Ankara.
Alp Esmer with our VOA Turkish service. Alp, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Jim.
Up next, we have our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, right here in Studio 22 to tell us what people are saying about this explosion in Ankara. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. So many media accounts are obviously tweeting about it, including New York Times and AP, and both of the tweets are putting the death toll at least 27. Mm. But Reuters is tweeting the blast killed at least 32 people. Now, Jim, the latest news related to the explosion is about a ban on access to Facebook and Twitter.
It's pretty interesting. What's happening exactly?
So an Ankara court ordered a ban on a number of social media sites, including those two in Turkey Sunday, after people began sharing images of the car bombing. The court argued the ban is to prevent showing victims of the tragedy on social media platforms without their consent. Now, international broadcasters shared some of those early images, but it seems like local users can't access it anymore.
Well, that's not the first time that the Turkish government has blocked access to social
media sites, right? It blocked access to Twitter last year. That was over the sharing of photographs of a prosecutor being held at gunpoint by militants.
So, what else is trending online today?
The U.S. politics continue to dominate the social media platform, as you can imagine. Former Republican presidential contender Ben Carson endorsing Donald Trump is still trending. He released an official statement on the issue Friday and even sent out a few tweets about it. One of them reads like this: "I endorse Donald Trump. It's time to unite behind the candidate who will beat Hillary Clinton and return the government to we the people." On the Democratic side, a skit about Hillary Clinton morphing into Bernie Sanders, his growing rival. A member of the popular Saturday Night Live, better known as SNL here in the States, series poked fun at Clinton, allegedly adopting many of Sanders' rhetoric in order to gain support from millennials. Billionaire investor George Soros is also in the headlines for contributing $50 million into a new super PAC to mobilize Latino and immigrant voters. As you know, Soros is an immigrant himself, born in Hungary. That's all for me today, Jim.
Oh, well, that's a great wrap-up. Thank you so much, G. G. Abby Lee is on Twitter by that very same name. Imagine that, at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well, at VOA Stevenson. And our program account is at VOA underscore IE. We invite each and every one of you to follow us. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Republican nominee for president may become extremely clear this week as VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins us to look at the latest voting scheduled for Tuesday.
Well, Jim, we could know by, say, midnight on Tuesday who the presumptive Republican nominee will be for president. I'm not saying that we will, but depending on how it goes, we could have a very good indication. Five big states hold primary elections on Tuesday: Florida and Ohio, but also Illinois, Missouri, and North Carolina. And in all but two of them, Illinois and North Carolina, these are winner-take-all states. In other words, if one candidate gets one more vote than everybody else,
that's
that
right,
candidate gets all the delegates that are up for grabs in that state. So, for instance, if businessman Donald Trump had a really good night, his delegate lead could be padded to such an extent that it would be difficult to see how he could be overcome by anyone else. I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but it is among the possibilities that are out there.
We have former Ohio Governor John Kasich, who will be competing in his home state. From the polls I've seen, he's behind. Marco Rubio is a senator, U.S. senator, struggling in his home state of Florida.
Between the two, Kasich in Ohio is thought to be stronger than Rubio in Florida. I mean, most political observers view the Rubio campaign as essentially being on life support with a faulty cord going into the wall. But no, he is down behind Donald Trump by double digits. This is a state that if he were going to have any chance at all, he should have a commanding lead.
And it really has almost become now a Trump-Hillary Clinton campaign. You see in their speeches references to the other constantly. Hillary very critical of the latest Donald Trump rallies where there's been some violence, one in Chicago actually called off.
This is really uncharted territory for presidential politics. At least, you know, I just can't think of anything in my lifetime that compares to this presidential cycle that we're in, where you have fistfights breaking out at rallies, fistfights breaking out outside of rallies, police getting involved, rallies being canceled, genuine security fears. Mm-hmm. There was someone who rushed the stage where Donald Trump was speaking, and there was that moment when when the Secret Service surrounded him. This is really uncharted territory, at least in modern presidential politics. And exactly how this plays out, I don't know. It's truly an honor to be a reporter because, my gosh, this is interesting stuff that we get to dig our hands into.
Yes, we enjoy playing out the process every Monday with Michael Bowman. He's our VOA Senate correspondent. And, Michael, thanks so much for stopping by.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks.
Well, we get an interesting glimpse into the workings of presidential delegates and the nominating process from right here in Washington, where the relatively small contingent of registered Republicans in the nation's capital, a traditional Democratic Party stronghold, turned out in heavy numbers Saturday. Florida Senator Marco Rubio won the contest with 37% of the vote. That was just 1 point ahead of John Kasich, the former Ohio governor. And it was unusual in several ways. My colleague Michael Lippin was there, and he joins us now to tell us how. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Jim. Well, it was unusual mainly because of the record turnout. Now, there was only one place in D.C. where Republicans could vote. This was a hotel in downtown D.C., and so many voters showed up that a huge line formed outside, stretching across three city blocks. Now, from getting in line to actually voting inside the hotel, people had to wait around 2.5 hours. But that didn't deter the 2,800 people who actually voted. Now, I caught up with two Republican officials outside the hotel, one with the Republican National Committee, or RNC, and another, Joe Brookman, who's with the D.C. Republican Party. I asked Brookman what he thought was bringing out so many voters.
I think it has to do with where the election is and the candidates are at the moment. People want to come out and support their views, so it's really endorsing who they believe and what they believe. And if you'd like to, this is Tony Parker right here. Tony? This yes. gentleman is from the Voice of America.
Okay. Hi, I'm Tony Parker.
Hi, nice,
Tony
to, meet
nice to meet you.
With the RNC. He's the financial?
No, I'm the treasurer of the RNC. Treasurer of the RNC.
Okay. What do you think about the big turnout today for this primary?
I think it's incredible small D democracy. I think it's fabulous. There is a real yearning in the city for an alternative to the Democrats. And that's what you're seeing here today.
In terms of the organization of this primary, people are having to wait quite a long time in line.
Who'd have thunk?
Yeah, so do you think there should have been maybe some better planning here?
Some days you just get overwhelmed. And who would have thought that these many people would have shown up one Saturday afternoon? We have never had anything like this in the history of our party.
Okay.
So we never, historically, we would have this kind of people, but they would come out to the 194
precincts.
We have only one. And the only reason we did is because the Democrats refused to allow to have their primary in a time that would allow us to be qualified so we could qualify for the convention. So they sort of stuck it to us. And so we've had to put it on ourselves. And we had no idea that we'd have this kind of a turnout. But it's incredible.
And what do you think is behind it?
I think people are really caring. I think they're people are really engaged in this election. I think they're tired of what they've seen in the last 8 years, and they want to change. And that's what you're seeing.
And your estimate of the turnout today?
I don't know. Joe, what do you think?
We thought we were going to have a couple thousand, maybe three.
I thought it was going to be 1,000, 1,500.
Yeah.
I mean, holy, none of us in our wildest dreams would have thought we would have gotten this. I mean, it really is a testament to small-D democracy.
And how important is the D.C. Primary in the context of the overall election?
Well, we're the only primary today, so the focus is on the District of Columbia today. And every vote counts, and you have no idea. We've got 19 votes. We've got as many as like four or five other states. I mean, 19 votes may make a difference to somebody.
19 delegates.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Excuse me, delegates, and that may make a difference. So it's very important, potentially.
Well, speaking of delegates, the final results showed that Rubio got 10 of the 19 delegates at stake, while Kasich got the other 9. Donald Trump finished third with 14% of the vote, while Senator Ted Cruz was last with 12%. But because neither of them passed a 15% threshold, they didn't get any delegates from the D.C. contest.
Well, what do you make of Cruz coming in last?
Well, to explain that, let me tell you another reason why this contest was so unusual: who the voters were. Many D.C. Republicans work as congressional staffers and lobbyists. You know, those are people that cynics typically refer to as the Republican establishment. Now, Ted Cruz is a serving senator, but he's built up a reputation over years as someone who engages in frequent political fights with his fellow Republicans, so much so that Cruz portrays himself as anti-establishment. And when you look at the results, it's obvious that he hasn't made many friends in that establishment. He got even fewer votes than Trump, who's not so popular with establishment Republicans either, Jim.
Well, pretty interesting development. Ted Cruz, knowing how he is politically, may be able to use that to his advantage, he's not establishment.
He might wear that as a badge of honor. You
Absolutely.
Never know.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for that report, Michael. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
The passage of time is a common musical theme. It relates to all of us. Pink Floyd's legendary Dark Side of the Moon album devoted much of its outpouring to that subject, including a track titled Time. Now, 43 years of time has passed since it was released. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins us with perspective as Dark Side of the Moon remains a huge fan favorite.
It's an ageless album, Jim. On March 10th, 1973, Harvest Records released Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd in the United States. And this was an album that the band had been working on for quite some time. They had developed the songs during live performances, and they performed an early version of the album in February 1972 at the Rainbow Theater in London, a full year before the album was released.
And those fans lucky, and they didn't know.
Exactly. The critics raved about it. They said it was some of the best music Pink Floyd had ever made. The album itself was recorded from June 1972 to January 1973 at the famous Abbey Road Studios in London. And it was a unified piece of music. The songs flowed into each other using special sound effects and spoken word excerpts. It took a lot of the concepts and ideas that Pink Floyd had used in their earlier albums. This was their eighth album. Mm. But it was a much more unified piece of work than anything they'd done before. It looked at themes of greed, the passage of time, themes of mental illness, which was partly inspired by the mental breakdown of one of their founding members, Syd Barrett, in the late 60s. And people absolutely responded to it. Roger Waters, their bassist, said that he played the album for his wife, and she burst into tears at the end of it. So he says, right at that moment, I knew that we were going to find an audience. It certainly did. Dark Side of the Moon remained on the U.S. album charts for 741 total weeks from 1973 to 1988. And no other album has ever done this.
That's astounding.
It only was number one for 1 week, but it hung around the charts for 741 total weeks. The album sold an estimated 45 million copies worldwide. It's one of the best-selling albums of all time. And moreover, Dark Side of the Moon elevated Pink Floyd from a respected mid-level rock band to a global superstar act, where they remained right up until the end of their career.
Technology also helped this album because we were so familiar with it, and by the time the 90s rolled around and CDs came out, we had almost a fresh listen to it.
Yeah, it was always a favorite among headphone listeners because of the depth of the production and the complexity of it all. FM radio stations of the 1970s would often play the entire record side as one track flowed into the next. In addition, it had a couple hit singles, Time, mm-hmm. Money. Everybody knew the music, and it seemed like every subset of music fans found something to like about it. Its appeal went right across the board, and it is 43 years old this week.
Speaking of numbers, we like our favorite number. That's the top 20 countdown. Ray McDonald is your host. Ray's also on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Follow him. Listen to him. Thanks for joining us, Ray.
Thank you, Jim.
The time is gone. The song is over. Thought I'd something more to say.
Amazing, amazing production work on that album. You've been listening to International Edition. We've had some amazing production work behind the scenes on our own program. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer, Daryl Smith. Thank you both so much. Join us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and come back again for our program. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington, hoping you have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is concerned about the deterioration of freedom of the press and internet in Malaysia, a friend and partner of the United States. Mired in allegations of corruption involving high-level officials, the Malaysian government is misusing a variety of laws to crack down on independent media. The Malaysian legislature voted last year to tighten restrictions on speech by increasing the 1948 Sedition Act's penalties to include allegedly seditious material on social media. Though the government uses the Sedition Act, national security, and other laws more frequently to stifle dissent, Malaysia's vibrant array of independent media continue to publish stories on alleged corruption. Over the past year, the Malaysian government blocked at least 12 popular media outlets, including Sarawak Report, Asia Sentinel, and the blocking platform Medium. Then, in late February, it blocked the domestic website, The Malaysian Insider. The United States is very concerned by the government of Malaysia's actions to restrict access to domestic and international reporting on Malaysian current affairs, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a written statement. We are further troubled that the government has not acted transparently, nor provided due process to the targeted media organizations and platforms prior to blocking access, and that the government of Malaysia has initiated criminal investigations against reporters, editors, and publishers from a variety of Malaysian and international media organizations. Of equal concern, many Malaysian social media users face charges for postings critical of the government and national leaders, wrote spokesperson Kirby. Rule of law, transparency, and the free flow of information are at the heart of modern democracies with competitive economies. Criminalizing speech stymies innovative thinking and undermines citizens' trust in the institutions of government. Such restrictions make it harder for countries to thrive and prosper. The United States and Malaysia have built a strong, comprehensive partnership through which we hope to expand our cooperation on a range of shared challenges, said Mr. Kirby. In that context, we urge the government of Malaysia to ensure that all its laws, existing and future, fully respect freedom of expression, including the free flow of ideas on the Internet.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From the Voice